So also meeting at the same time as the Citizens Police Review Board at 5 o'clock on Monday, May 13th. They're meeting in the City Manager's Conference Room, which is where you go if you want to find the mayor. Go look for the mayor's office, and the conference room is right next to it. It's right close to the drinking fountain, which is near the bathrooms, which are near the City Council chambers, if that tells you anything. And that's, again, CPR, the Citizens Police Review Board at 5. People are continuing to file complaints regarding police misconduct, and there was some suggestion of filing a complaint against the Parks and Rec employee who has been watering the lawns and sometimes watering the demonstrators and calling the cops on circumstances where demonstrators are lying on the grass, under the theory that a demonstrator lying on the grass is sort of an obscenity to see, just as a demonstration is an eyesore. And it hurts the grass. Well, the law is regarding this issue. If it is not a sign posted, keep out the grass, and you don't have to keep out the grass. So unless they want to turn these into ornamental Japanese gardens, then it has to accommodate everybody. And if the city wants to refuse to recognize the rights of people to sleep at night, and indeed the rights of people to use public facilities at night, then they're going to end up with people sleeping and piles of shit. I mean, let's get real here, folks. That's the reality of it. You can belly and moan all you want. You can whine and complain all you want. You can be as bigoted as you want on the issue, but it doesn't change the human realities of the situation. Now, I'm not on the best of terms with the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, but I still have occasional contact with folks who are indeed involved with that program. And here we have an interview with Ron Howard, who's the operations manager of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, I should say the RUMP program, the little teeny remaining program that gives, I guess, space to, it's either 26 or 52 or people, something like that, at night. Spaces that are pretty much taken up. You can't really qualify by walking over there and standing usually there. I think you have to book them in advance. Let's hear what Ron has to say.
It's about 15 to 2 on May 3rd, 1996. I'm here on the corner of Pacific and Church talking to Ron Howard. And Ron, you're biking through town here, but when you're not biking, you're often working for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, correct? So how's everything going with that program?
Well, as you know, we're going into reduced mode in the summertime. The needs aren't as great or as pressing for our homeless populations there in the winter. We only handle 28 people in-house in Santa Cruz and 14 people in Watsonville. And as you know, both the armories have been closed, and there is some doubt and or concern with our population of whether they're going to be available to us next year or not. That's at the state level, and you know, we need to petition the people in Sacramento to make sure that we have adequate housing for the people that need it in the seasons when we do have to have it. Of course, they just had the groundbreaking for the community house project.
I saw that in the paper, May 1st.
I was surprised you weren't there.
Well, you know, I was up at Stanford with a thing called the Stanford Homeless Action Coalition. They were concerned about the rights of the homeless rather than, let's say, removing the rights of the homeless, like the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which runs community house, in my opinion, did when they evicted the campers from Coral Street and instead set up this rather costly trailer project.
You know, this has caused some serious divisiveness among large fragments of our community, with the city, the county, and the people that concern me most, the homeless themselves. As with yourself, Robert, I mean, you've been working with homeless issues for years. Sometimes it's so frustrating and so difficult to make even the smallest inroads or gains for the population that needs it the most.
Oh, yeah. Well, I understand this project is still awaiting a HUD grant, right?
That is my understanding.
And ultimately, this is a $600,000 a year upkeep project, which serves people who pay $617 a month, right?
I don't know what the numbers are, to tell you the truth. And that seems right. I'd heard low end as little as $150 and then up to $600.
Once they get some kind of grant funding for it.
They're also talking about, though, instead of incorporating as many people as possible into the program, they want to start off very slowly and establish a stable population to begin with. And they're talking about bringing in only 5 people initially, when they'll have a facility that can house as many as 45 people. So you tell me.
So, I guess the projected date for opening it up is July, right?
They're saying July 1st. I think that's an unrealistic date. With the amount of progress that's taken place and with the permit process still ongoing, I think it's going to slip back.
I also heard that at least one of the churches that was taking up the slack, the Garfield Park Church, was allowing people to park and to some extent even to illegally camp, has now told the people that they can no longer, as of May 1st, the same date, sleep or camp in that area.
And Reverend Hasty, a wonderful man, has supported us for a long, long time, legally and illegally. Was loath to tell those folks that they couldn't do it anymore, but he was approached by
neighbors,
city, who had contacted the city and said, hey, look, we don't want the same thing happening up here that happened on Coral Street. And I don't see any reason for fear. I mean, they're parked on private property. They were everyone's responsibility, not the city's. But that's just a matter of, you know, the community peer pressure coming together and saying, hey, we don't want it.
So who in the city contacted the Reverend, do you know?
It was my understanding that it was the public relations people through the SCPD.
So they were preserving good relations with the neighbors, perhaps?
Exactly.
So how many people had been sleeping there, and how many people?
In the morning when I get there, Robert, there would be as many as 7 or 8 campers, 2 to 3 people per camper. And one morning I showed up there and Squirrel had his tent set up in the lawn.
That's all. I've seen Squirrel around. Is Holy Cross still taking people sleeping outside, or?
You have to go through the administrative offices up there to clear with them, but it is my understanding that they are allowing people to sleep overnight there.
And how many churches are actually part of this program that allow you to, bye-bye, to park on the property and sleep there, on the church garage or church parking lot area?
We're about 8 or 10 that allow people to, if they have a vehicle, to park it on the property, but they have to be gone by a certain time. And of course there are days when they don't want them to do it, particularly like Saturday night when they have services early Sunday morning, things like that. So, you know, that's just a band-aid tour.
So, and these of course are for people who have vehicles, right? Not for people who are without vehicles.
The people without vehicles have gone back out into the woods.
What do you hear about camping tickets for those in the woods? Nothing, some, lots?
I've only heard of one since they closed the back 40. And that gentleman,
I saw three on the court calendar 2 days ago.
Really?
Oh yeah. Hmm. Two for a Spanish fellow, and then another for a, I wrote his name down.
Is that related to the shooting?
No, I don't think so. I think that they were just ordinary, they were camping tickets that came out on a failure to appear. And the failure to appear was, they were also connected with some other minor charge, I think. And I see at least 4 or 5 camping tickets a week in the courts when I go in there, and I go in there every day, and I don't check the calendar every day, so.
Can I ask you a question that's a little disjointed here, Rob?
Sure.
We've had numerous conversations over the last couple of years, and you know and are aware that today was Paul Marceau's last day.
No, I wasn't actually.
He submitted his retirement 2 weeks ago, and effective today, he is no longer executive director. How do you feel about that?
Well, who's the new executive director?
They're not going to fill his position.
Really? What's the significance
initially?
Well, does it give you more freedom as a worker yourself?
It's going to give you more latitude, yeah. But I'm not sure if I want it.
I'm sympathetic with Paul in many respects, and I also am very critical of him as well. You've heard me be critical as well. As an individual, he's a very well-spoken guy. He seems to have his heart in the right place. He's, as service providers go,
worse than any of the others.
Probably no worse than any of the others. The problem that, of course, he had was he was an official or an appointed negotiator for the CCH. He made commitments and promises to the River Street, the Coral Street Open Air Shelter folks, and violated them. And then, of course, he was the executive officer who essentially enforced this by calling in the cops and closing down the campground. And in doing this, he got a significant black mark against him in my book. I mean, against everybody he evicted. I mean, it was wrong for him to do that. He did, and not only tried to hold him accountable before the Citizens Committee, I think he initiated action. Paul Lee, of course, was also very much culpable in this situation as the executive director and as an individual who I think exercised a personal grudge against me to silence an issue that really had a responsibility to respond to, which was the fact that the promises that had been tape recorded had been made, and I said they wanted to play this tape for the board, not the executive board, the ordinary board. And course, they stopped me, they shut me up, and the next time I came to the meeting, they tried to have me arrested. Called the cops twice for trespass. So, just whether they erred in those matters. He also, Palmer, so I think, erred in, when I complained about this in a letter, his response was not to give the matter to a neutral third party, but to make a decision himself, to judge his own conduct, and to make a judgment about my requests. For example, that his meetings be tape recordable, as they have always been in the past, that they be open to the media, that they be open to any member of the public that wants to come. And his response to that was essentially a series of sophisms, I thought, that had little to do with the substantive issues involved and were personal attacks on me. So I'm disappointed with how he responded to me in that situation.
Well, I really can't grudge you for that remark, because there were things that could have been handled differently, they could have been handled better, and unfortunately they weren't. And the resolution that came down affected a lot of people in a negative manner. And, well, I mean, that's water under the bridge now. All we can do is just try and do it differently in the future, right?
I agree completely. The reason I keep raising the issue is, you see, it's not simply the Citizens Committee that's to blame for this. It's the city, which backed up the Citizens Committee with police and city council muscle. It's the city which refuses to find a new campground area for homeless people. It's the county, which also has much more space to do much more with what they had if they wanted to. And so, in a way, the reason I keep raising the issue is because the problem was created by the closing of Coral Street is one that no one is addressing. And so it has to be continually raised again, I think.
I agree. And the city and county like to treat it as a seasonal kind of issue, it seems. That if you're homeless, you're homeless 356 days a year, regardless if it's 100 degrees outside or if it's 40 degrees and raining.
That's right.
You know, this is something that we need to address in an annual kind of sense instead of just when it gets cold and wet.
You've been homeless yourself.
Indeed I have. I was homeless for 3.5 years. I just recently got out of homeless, as a matter of fact, 6 months ago. And it's damn difficult to break the cycle. And once you do get a break, if you don't work your butt off,
you step again. Now you're at the same fucking scene.
That's it, exactly.
I thought you'd introduce me to that woman immediately, but let's not even discuss that. So, I'll talk to you again, and thank you very much, Ron Howard. We'll have another conversation.
Enjoy the day, sir.
Thank you.
And perhaps we can get more of an update from Ron on what's actually been going on now that we're 10 days further along, and it's May 13th. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, Bathropes, Piers, Broadsides. This is the recorded version, and hopefully you're going to be hearing me live again on Friday, and if not, perhaps you'll be hearing Beggar Backer Becky Johnson live on Friday. I will be in jail if that's the case, or near it, and hopefully everyone will send those cards and letters in, and we'll give you information on how to send in those large donations, cannabis brownies, and so forth. Speaking of cannabis, there is, of course, an ongoing controversy. The radio station, as you may know, had its problems with the Cannabis Collective. And there are still some problems outstanding between Ed Fry, who is the lessee who holds the lease for the building in which the Cannabis Collective folks are, also has a law office there, and the Cannabis Collective, and they are on rent strike because of Ed Fry's eviction notice to them. He has evicted them not because he disagrees with what they're doing, as I understand it from Ed, as far as they're providing marijuana to those who need it medically, but he is concerned with the actions of one of their number, a man named Neil, who I guess it was a week ago or so, I guess it was Monday night, maybe it was Sunday night, a week ago Sunday, broke down the door of the Free Radio, and in the course of that activity assaulted three different people, at least that's the report of two of them, Phil Free and Bob Duran, and the third did call the police on Neil, and I was there when the police arrived. I didn't witness any of the actual breaking down of the door. Neil, for his part, claims that he himself admits he was intoxicated, admits he came back from Palomar on the Cinco de Mayo, that's when it was, intoxicated, but he says he was assaulted on the way home by several folks on the mall who had sort of said he had closed down Free Radio because there had been some friction between Neil and Free Radio, and indeed Free Radio had chosen to move, and announced it was going to move under pressure from the Cannabis Collective, both of whom at that time were in the same building. I don't think this is secret information anymore for those who are worried about it. It's public information for a lot of us, and also an important public issue that's come up. Anyway, when Neil got back, there had been numerous complaints about the free radio from the Cannabis Collective, but complaints that had not really effectively reached the Free Radio Collective. And no members of the Cannabis Collective ever attended one meeting of the Free Radio Collective in the course of all their complaints. They channeled their complaints through Ed Fry and other people. It never really, there were concerns about noise and concerns about friction between members of the Cannabis Collective and the Radio Collective. There were concerns mainly about after December, when Fred Psyche moved into the building, he was kind of shepherding the Cannabis Collective program. He's an older man who had recently had a stroke, and he needed quiet around the house, and cannabis, and the free radio people, some of them were not respecting that, or were not aware of that, and it wasn't effectively communicated. And so eventually there was a big blow up and a quick threat that everybody had to leave, or the statement was that security would remove the free radio, even though the Cannabis Collective was not in any way the leaseholder of the building. Both Free Radio and the Cannabis Collective were leasee or subleasees, as I understand it, sublessees from Ed Fry. Though indeed, the Cannabis Collective pointed out it paid the lion's share of the rent and still does, and that's the power that it's using in this rent strike, which they originally threatened to do if Free Radio didn't leave, which it did. But now they're threatening to do because Ed Fry has initially evicted, I believe, Neil, the man who broke down the door. That's claiming it was the second such violent incident over a period of time, and that Neil had promised not to repeat that incident, and he'd done it again. I think Ed is concerned that this is an alcohol-related problem, whereas Neil's friends claim that he has no alcohol problem, any more than any other person. But it's a big can of worms, and I was trying to mediate this over the weekend to try to get both sides together, and hopefully they will get together, although I haven't heard that they are getting together around this issue. Instead, I'd asked Free Radio to lay off attacks on Neil, per se, because he apparently was physically assaulted himself down on the mall. And what we need here is some kind of meeting of the minds. We need some kind of understanding that everybody, a number of people have been injured. We want to stop this kind of stuff from escalating in some kind of petty gang war here, which is ridiculous. That's my position. There's also a lot of concerns about the Cannabis Club I heard raised at the Free Radio meeting last night. Namely that the Cannabis Club sells its marijuana at street prices instead of giving it away. And this is an inappropriate practice for a club that wants to really see the spreading of marijuana, and that there's so many growers in the area that it should be doable without cost, as some of the speakers claimed had been the case before the current management of the Cannabis Club came in. Now, I hope to interview the Cannabis Club on this issue. I don't wish to state any particular position myself. I regard myself as friends to people in the Cannabis Club, friends to people in Free Radio, and no doubt that's going to all end as I air these concerns. But this is an issue of real public concern. I think we need to find ways to work together, or at least not in each other's hair. And that was one of the reasons that the Free Radio Collective moved. And I think it was a positive step. And I think what's needed now is some kind of restitution to be made between Neil and those people who have been injured by him. And there also needs to be a resolution between Ed Fry and the Cannabis Collective. I don't know how that can happen. I think Ed has proposed maybe some kind of alcohol program for Neil, but you can't. A compulsory alcohol program is not a positive, necessarily positive thing. It has to be undertaken voluntarily by the person who does it, not simply because he's ordered to do so. Court-ordered stuff, whatever. Notwithstanding. So I thought I'd mention this simply because it is a newsworthy item, and I think that it's something that needs to be considered, and all sides in this issue need to be considered, not just one side or the other. And there's so little communication going on between these groups, and nobody, again, from the Cannabis Collective attended the Free Radio meeting. I don't have any time to do the mediating kind of back and forth work that needs to be done. I tried to put both sides in touch with a mediator. I did, in fact, contact a mediator this weekend. So we'll see what's happening. I hope that one gets resolved. I don't know what to encourage the audience to do other than to don't take a side, learn what's going on, and try to find a resolution to this. That's my suggestion.
Well, now we finally reached Captain Jammer Keith McHenry, the Food Not Bombs felon, who I guess his felony has now melted away into a misdemeanor. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Well, yeah, we have really no idea what happened with that, but we hope.
That's right. So you are currently not embroiled. Actually, you were arrested at one point, but you had called the police chief, and you got the arrestees off your back about in early April, or the arresting officers, and here we are in mid-May, May 13th, and what's happening with Food Not Bombs?
Let's see, we're still serving three times on Monday in the day, and we aren't actually getting busted in San Francisco right now. It's not clear how long that will last, or what's going on. But another interesting phenomenon was that yesterday's protest, or Saturday's protest against immigrants, tax on immigrants, there was almost no cops out, which is very unusual for a San Francisco protest. There were probably busloads of cops out of sight, but there was almost no cops that were visible. Maybe two at one point.
Was the same situation at the May 8th Matrix demonstration, where you were cowering behind your table expecting to be arrested at any point, and no police arrived to oblige you.
Yeah, well, there were more cops at that protest than at the protest for immigrant rights.
So I think that they're doing their usual paranoid number with respect to the person of the mayor. After all, the protest that we did on the 8th was outside the mayor's office.
City Hall. Also, homeless groups versus other groups sometimes, too. They may not have had a clear understanding that they should be shaking in their boots about IUDA and these other organizations.
How big was that protest this weekend?
It was probably about 200 people.
And what
it was not as big as people had expected, actually.
What did it involve?
And we met at Cesar Chavez and Mission Street and marched to 24th, where there were a couple of speeches at 24th and Mission, and then we marched down to 16th and Mission, where most people spoke, and that's where we shared free food.
What were the major demands or concerns of the protesters?
Well, they were, one thing which I thought was interesting in what little coverage there was on the mainstream media, they did get this one main point, which was that we're not really in support of the Democrats or the Republicans' proposals on immigrant laws, that both of them are the enemy of poor people, both parties, and that that this whole idea, and generally speaking, that people have a right to work and to live and to get health care and education, no matter where they were born and where they're being raised, and quite frankly, the manipulations that are going on economically by the large transnational corporations are as much our concern, whether it's happening to people in Mexico or Central America or in the U.S., and that it's, everybody's right to have their basic needs met.
Any specific demands in terms of existing legislation? Any particular concerns about recent INS actions in San Francisco?
Definitely to pull the INS out of San Francisco, and particularly to keep the INS out of the Mission. To no collusion between the San Francisco police and the INS, something that happens frequently. It's supposed to not be happening as much now, but apparently that's still going on. Also, to do a number of other things. One is, of course, to roll back the 187 in California, and then the federal 187 that Feinstein and Boxer Pelosi put for. Also to get rid of English-only laws, those kind of things, and to generally, to stop this kind of race-baiting stuff that the government does to try to divide the community so that we're not unified in our opposition to the Republicans and the Democrats and the types of things things that they're forcing on the public.
Yeah, San Francisco is a city of minorities. You have Chinese, you have Philippine, you have Japanese, you have Hispanic, you have black, among only a few, you have French. I mean, you've got all kinds of,
Russian people now.
And this kind of, I don't know if it's a melting pot or you might say a multicultural reality in San Francisco, how does that affect, let's say, the situation for homeless people? Are homeless people mostly English-speaking white males? Are they? Do you have any racial stats on that?
Well, unfortunately, probably a majority of homeless people are male African-Americans. A huge percentage, you know, might be 35-40%. But there is also a large number of Latino homeless people, and that frequently happens. Even with we hear a lot of stories of people who are picked up by the police and lose their green card and everything they have, like an actual job and stuff, and just because they're picked up for being Hispanic and put in jail for 30 days, end up losing their jobs, and then they don't have green cards, and so then they're living on the streets. So that there's that story is a common story. There's also a fair number of white people that are living on the streets, and a lot of people that live on the streets were born in San Francisco, something that the local media and the local politicians don't like to admit to. But I have a number of friends that live on the streets in San Francisco who were born here and have been here their whole lives. One of my friends who was born here lives on the street. He's a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson, and he probably took me to some kind of museum downtown where he showed his parents' line. He's an African American. He was actually one of Jefferson's slaves. Descendants. So,
as you are a descendant of one of some early American doodah yourself, right?
That kind of stuff. So it's interesting. Yeah. These people are living. That's how why he came to me and talked to me about this and took me to this museum to see this this documentation. The other thing is that the population of people living on the streets. There's a number of people, as was pointed out at the Matrix protests, who are people who do not want to, they don't necessarily want to live on the streets, but they just do not want to spend their time working for this political system and this economic system. And that actually should be more and more considered a legitimate perspective, because, I certainly am not interested in that.
Let me ask you.
I have my 200 jobs and I got fired from and hated. And mm-hmm. So.
Did you were at the Matrix demonstration, as was I, last May 8th, I guess a week ago on Wednesday.
Right.
And you said that there was some coverage of it in the media, but not much.
Very little. I was so shocked for all those TV cameras. There was like this one little, less than 30-second spot practically on I think Channel 7 and nothing on Channel 2 and on the other stations. So
anything about Willie Brown running away from the demonstration?
They had a little bit on that one little spot, and that was it. And also even KPFA radio had very little time devoted. It had Wendell Harper interviewing two different people, just two sound bites, and it was off. And here's something that is very important. The idea, I mean, this is sort of in a sense a watershed protest, because everybody's falling for this line that Willie Brown is going to let people camp in the parks and stuff like that, and of course that he actually was not intending to do that.
And actually didn't say that. He
didn't say that.
But he did say that he was going to allow people to sleep at night without being arrested.
Yeah, but you can't have a blanket or a sleeping bag or any of those things.
But even then, I understand people are still being hassled for sleeping.
They are actually being hassled for sleeping.
And ticketed for sleeping.
And ticketed. And in fact, people are being arrested and ticketed more than under the Jordan administration. There's a lot more, the police are much more abusive in general. And seems to me, although this is interesting that there was a, again, less, there's almost no cops. Like with the cops that they had at City Hall on the Matrix one, they had a bus behind City Hall, and then they had the Honda cops lining, inside the door to City Hall. And that could be as much because of animosity towards Willie Brown as it is towards the demonstrators.
You know, getting back to this question of the racial mix in San Francisco, or the ethnic mix, here in Santa Cruz, we also have a Hispanic population. We have a very depressed area, the beach flats, where there's a lot of cocaine sales and so forth. And there's always been concern among activists that there be a uniting of the different struggles, or at least a mutual supporting of the struggles, that hasn't happened here. What's happening up there? Is there a supporting? I know when I was arrested in San Francisco in 1993 for serving free food, I went to jail with three Hispanic guys, you know, and who were also serving food. Actually, they weren't serving food, they were just delivering food. They were, I don't know if you remember them, they were hauled off and they'd arrived with some food.
Yeah, well, that was the people, some of the people from IUDA who helped co-sponsor Saturday's protest, and in fact, they lost their van, I believe, in that case, which took us,
You mean back in 1993?
Yeah, it took us about half a year to get their truck back. It was another case of attempting to, where my calls and the calls to from IUDA to the police, the police would intentionally make racist comments and claim that we were racist to the IUDA people. It was interesting that, oh, they're not doing anything about this. And here I made the dozens of calls trying to divide the two organizations based on race again. They did get their vehicle back.
Is IUDA any closer to Food Not Bombs than it was, let's say, in 1993?
Oh, yeah, much closer now. We're, like, very tight.
Now, you also have this situation coming up where one of your members is facing 2 months in jail on Thursday. Is there going to be a loud outcry from IUDA and others in the Spanish community around my case? Because I indeed am that person who's...
Definitely so. There are people who are coming from the, you know, we handed out flyers, I'd say about 300 for your case on Saturday, total at two different events.
So in Spanish or English?
Unfortunately in English, because mm-hmm. We didn't get time to translate it to Spanish. But we did talk, you know, most people there were actually English speaking, even if they were of Latino background.
Now this is, of course, the sentence remodification or modification hearing coming up at 3 p.m. on Thursday, May 16th, in my case of serving free food, and I was convicted of it. Sentenced to 2 months in jail. Now I'm going back after having gone through all my appeals, trying to get the sentence thrown out just by the original judge, modified to nothing, with the support, presumably, of District Attorney Terrence Hallinan. Now, we've heard that Amnesty International has issued at least two letters on this issue, but what in fact is the actual hard data in terms of their willingness to accept me as a prisoner of conscience in this situation? Have they made that offer? Is that only if I go to jail? Is it if I go to jail and eat vegetarian food? I mean, what's the basis there? What are the requirements?
Okay, what they say in their initial letter was that if the reason that you're going to jail turns out to be because of your political position, and that they believe that's why the 1,000 arrests are happening, then that you would be a prisoner of conscience. Now it becomes kind of more serious. I mean, that was initially what they're saying, but then they've sent a second letter, which is even more damning of the local government here, and let me see if I can get that letter. The issue was mentioned in the UN, I mean in the Amnesty International Human Rights Report for 1995 under the United States. So the newest letter, which is actually November of 95, the Amnesty International wrote to you, this is to dear Arlo Smith, the former district attorney, said Amnesty wrote to you last year regarding the case of several individuals belonging to the Food Not Bombs group, letter dated 28 of October. Our reference is TGAMR, and then it's 515094. No reply was received from your office. I'm writing you once again to seek further information from you regarding reports that San Francisco police continue to harass and arrest volunteer members of Food Not Bombs group, apparently on account of their attempt to feed homeless people and to disseminate information on peace and social justice issues. Amnesty International remains concerned that Food Not Bombs activists may be subjected to continuing police surveillance and harassment on account of their nonviolent activities. Their meal service for the homeless in San Francisco's public places is regularly disrupted, with food and literature confiscated, and hundreds of individuals have been arrested during 1995, sometimes being held for 1 or 2 days in jail before the charges against them were reduced or dropped. Amnesty International has also disturbed reports of continuing police brutality and use of force, which would seem both disproportionate and uncalled for given the nonviolent stance of the activists in question. Amnesty International has reviewed videotapes which show police using unnecessary force to arrest individuals who offer no resistance whatsoever. Some complain that they were beaten and ill-treated while in police custody. Christopher Allen was arrested on February 14, 1995, after he brought a vat of oatmeal to a rally outside San Francisco's Hall of Justice and served one cup full to a homeless person. Police allegedly hauled him inside the Hall of Justice, threw him against a bench, and held him down, twisting his arms hard, while several officers stood on him. One officer held him in a chokehold, and Mr. Allen says he was unable to breathe for about 10 seconds. Heather Urquhart, a Canadian volunteer member of Food Not Bombs, was arrested at UN Plaza on the 27th of February, 1995, after she objected to the police removing a can of money placed on a literature table. According to reports, she was roughly handled and suffered pain, bruises, and torn ligaments when police officers twisted her legs and choked her. Reverend Al Craig was arrested on the 25th of June, 1995, and allegedly beaten while in police custody after refusing to remove a bracelet. According to the reports of other Food Not Bombs activists who witnessed the scene, Reverend Craig was repeatedly thrown to the floor, hit on the back, head, and neck, kicked in the butt, and kicked in the buttocks. He was detained overnight in jail and released the next day. Charges against him were reportedly reduced to misdemeanors. Amnesty International remains concerned at the apparent selective harassment to which Food Not Bombs activists have been subjected by the police. Evidence continues to suggest that this group is being penalized on account of its beliefs and is being prohibited from exercising its right to freedom of assembly and right to impart information. Once again, I would draw your attention to the fact that these rights are enshrined both in the U.S. Constitution and in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the USA has ratified and is bound by. For your ease of reference, I enclose a further copy of Amnesty International's previous letter. We are sending copies of this correspondence to Mayor Jordan, San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Pete Wilson, the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. We welcome an early response from you on matters raised, and we seek your assurance that the City of San Francisco and its Police Department will respect the right of the citizens to assemble peacefully in public places and engage in nonviolent, constitutionally protected activities. Sincerely yours, Wilder Taylor, Program Director for America's Region. And that's Amnesty International, 1 Eastern Street.
So they are indeed concerned with the systematic abuses that Food Not Bombs suffered last year, but I notice there's no mention of the best and most beloved of all Food Not Bombs activists, Robert Norris Kahn.
You were mentioned actually in the earlier letter enclosed. You were the subject of that letter. Actually, I don't have a copy, unfortunately, of that handy.
Mm-hmm.
But so they are not intentionally leaving you out of this. They just are referring to that as being the...
Well, what I'm trying to do is make sure I have accurate information when I say that I have been declared... Have I been declared a prisoner of conscience? Or will I be declared as uncertain at the moment?
What has to happen is, and actually we've been doing email to London's office, and you may want to ask them yourself today on the... as well. I haven't gone back to answer my email to see if they've responded yet. But
why don't you let me know by phone if you hear anything so I can accurately pass on the information down here. I mean, it is quite a feather in my cap, or I should say a carrot in my belt, to have Amnesty International
absolutely. It says
supporting this.
The sentence says that in the end of the last of the original Amnesty International press release that was sent out, was saying that if indeed it was found to be true that that people were being arrested because of their political beliefs and were sentenced to time in jail, they would be considered prisoners of conscience. And then this new letter that I just read, the newer letter makes it sound like they're pretty convinced that that's true.
Well, let us know if you actually get a, we're going to, you know, that you know, they're actually specifically singling me out for this honor because, you know, and of course I'll have to have
We will do it. It'll become world news, needless to say, and we're working on it as you, Hugh has been talking to them and we're trying to.
Sounds good.
To have. Now, the other, and I've faxed them information and so on about this as well, but we should maybe write a specific letter to, with using their reference number.
How's the media been treating my case up there in terms of the possible upcoming sentence modification?
Well, they've been, you know, friendly enough, but I'm saying that I have to say that the media is generally clamping down on its coverage of. You know, of our activities, a very little. We're being more marginalized than even before. I think once if Amnesty International is makes a public statement around this, and you do start to do time, there'll be like a protest, of course, outside of the Hall of Justice that will start up, or maybe in front of City Hall, something of that nature, and Hunger Fast while it's going on, and there's no doubt there will be a lot of activity happening.
Maybe one guy with a flyer.
Like me, I'll probably get to join you inside.
Well, I noticed there wasn't too much enthusiasm from Religious Witness on this issue, nor have I heard the Coalition on Homelessness doing too much, but you never can tell. I mean, I'd like to see it happen, and I think, you know, we have to, just as I was saying at the Coalition on Homelessness rally and against the Matrix on the 8th, we got to join together, because what we do is going to impact the continued Matrix program, I think. I think if we gotta use every possible avenue, and that's the reason I think that my case has some importance here, because it is so outrageous to send someone to jail for 2 months for serving free food, that you would hope that people would use this incident as a way of mobilizing support.
No, I think so. It's it is. Well, the whole thing is completely shocking as to what's going on in our community.
Anything else from San Francisco that you want to kind of pass on? We're running out of tape here in this.
Well, certainly I hope everyone will come up to Robert's hearing, and we have a protest plan. We're intending to risk arrest sharing free food outside of 850 Bryant Street, and we have like, you know, we're encouraging other people to join us, and it's likely that you would just, if we do get arrested, you would just spend the afternoon or the evening in jail and get to come up for, actually it seems like the cases are being discharged now because Hallinan's office is just discharging all food cases. But that's really important. And there's also going to be on the 15th and 16th of June.
For those interested, that's May 16th at 3 p.m. at City Hall, at Hall of Justice in San Francisco. And the caravan in Santa Cruz leaves at noon from our City Hall at 809 Center Street.
Oh, fantastic. And we also have like a radio conference that's happening on the 15th and 16th of June at, right now we believe it's at Horace Mann Middle School. And I think that'll probably be true. Then the other thing is that there's a forum against police repression in San Francisco on the 31st of May, Friday. And people who were in FUNAP bombs or who came up here to visit and were beaten by the police or harassed are certainly welcome to testify at that. And we're going to take the information from that. And so this is another area. If you are in jail, that certainly will become a hot topic in the police forum. And we've invited the chief of police and the deputy chief to attend, Dick Holder.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to videotape this event and then add that to the Amnesty International's body of information in this case that they have, and also in the United Nations Human Rights Commission case, which is the UN is investigating this, and its reference number is GSO2151 USA 297. And
perhaps they'll send in a peacekeeping force to make sure that.
I don't know. The Justice Department, however, has just blown us off totally.
Mm-hmm. Although the Justice Department, ironically, has filed a brief on behalf of homeless people, for example, both in the Tobe case and I think also in the Jensen case, and the Joyce case, I should say.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. In our case, the same videotapes, we previously reviewed a videotape forwarded to this office regarding the matter, and we conclude that no prosecutor violation of federal criminal civil rights.
Anything else? Because I gotta go.
You better go.
All right. Thanks, Keith.
And that was Captain Jammer Keith McHenry, San Francisco. I'm Bathrobe Spear Robert Norris. This is going to be an unusually short version of Bathrobe Spear's Broadsides, because I've run out of tape, and I've got to get this tape to the studio. If you want to be on the air, give a call to 423-4833 and leave a message. We'll get back to you. Go down to the City Hall Sleepout and support them. They're there 24 hours a day. They're on day 75. They need your help. They need your encouragement, if only for a brief period of time. And stay tuned for more tapes. We're going to be passing on some loop tapes of past interviews that you never heard before and that you should have heard, and hopefully you will hear. And most of all, if you're interested, do come to this caravan, which is, supports my and your right to serve free food, leaving from City Hall here in Santa Cruz, 809 Center Street, at noon on Thursday, May 16th. Another quick announcement, Wednesday evening at Ed Fry's office, I believe it starts at 7 o'clock, is going to be a meeting of attempt to start a new cannabis collective. And tomorrow, Tuesday, May 14th, City Council meets at 7 o'clock. If you want to come to speak to Oral Communications, you'll be able to speak your mind and your heart on what's going on here in Santa Cruz, or I should say what's not going on in terms of significant changes in the law. Thank you for tuning into my show. This is Bathrobe Spear Robert Norris. I hope to be with you on Friday. If I'm not, I hope to be talking to you by phone from jail, giving you some sort of insight as to what's going on inside the bowels of the beast up in San Francisco. Until then, remember, a law against sleep is an unjust law. Phone your city council, 429-3550. Thanks again.